Chapter 7. Witnesses to the Pilgrimage. The wind of Thrinos was cold and hard. It blew over the refugee camps, just strong enough to stir the fabric of the shelters of the more recent arrivals. They had not yet had time to build stronger, more rigid defences against its insistent, insidious touch. On the ramparts of the Iron Hands fortress, Sanguinius faced west, into the wind, looking out over the vista of misery.
"How many?" he asked Levanus.
"A few million, at our last estimate, Lord Sanguinius," the Raven Guard said.
He was acting as guide to the Angel, Ralderon, and the Sanguinary Guard. Gilliman had not yet descended from the Samothrace, and Sanguinius had chosen to learn the truths of the Desperate of Thrinos before his conference with his brothers.
"More are arriving all the time," Levanus said.
Sanguinius could feel the lion's eyes on him. From somewhere in the keep behind him, his brother was observing. It would be against his nature to do otherwise. "To know without being known. Isn't that it, brother?" Did the lion think his interest in the refugees was a waste of time? Perhaps, but perhaps not. The lion was not a machine. The keep was a structure of brutal, jutting walls and jagged angles. The Iron Hands had constructed it from the remains of broken ships. It was patchwork, but it was strong. There was a funereal quality to the structure. It was constructed from the bones of loss. Once proud vessels had been gutted by the years of battle. However many engagements Calibus's company had won, attrition was wearing them down and eating away at their strength. The fortress was defiant, but it was just as much a last resort as the shacks and tents that surrounded it. The refugees used whatever materials the Iron Hands discarded. Sanguinius saw constructions of plasteel and burnt, twisted shielding. A few miles to the northeast, the entire stern of a frigate, gutted of everything but the skeletons of the decks, had become the hard refuge of tens of thousands. Hundreds of fires, lit against the growing cold of the late afternoon, flickered in the huge shell.
"How are they fed?" Sanguinius asked.
"Well, there was a colony here before our arrival," said Levanus. "Not a major one, but enough to have developed an agricultural industry."
"I'm surprised," Ralderon said. "This does not strike me as a fertile world."
"It isn't. Not very. The settlers were miners. The colonists grew enough to subsist and had a small surplus to stockpile against the years of weak harvests."
Sanguinius frowned.
"And this influx of population is being fed by that surplus?"
"Essentially, yes," Levanus said.
"Hardly a long-term solution."
"No, it is not. Nothing on Thrinos is."
If the war ever came to Thrinos, the fortress would be swept away, along with everything else. Tents and shacks stretched to the horizon on all sides of the fortress. The size of the camps was a testament to loss, Sanguinius thought. So many refugees from so many worlds had come here. As he walked, a clamour rose from below, growing louder, becoming more and more distinct from the general din of the camp. He looked down the 100 feet of sheer ablative sheeting. A crowd was gathering at the foot of the wall. There were already a few thousand people. Their faces were upraised. They lifted their arms towards Sanguinius. They shouted and wept for joy. Sanguinius had seen some of this behaviour on Macrag after he had been proclaimed emperor. But word of the Imperium Secundus could not have reached Thrinos. And there was a frenzy, a desperation to the celebration that was new.
"Tell me what I am seeing," he said to Levanus.
"After years of despair, 3 Primarchs have come to Thrinos."
"That isn't all, though, is it?"
"No," Levanus admitted. "They are rejoicing at the sight of you, Lord Sanguinius, at what you represent."
He paused for a moment.
"Your symbolism?"
he added, grimacing an apology. Sanguinius nodded. That was hardly a new experience for him, though it had always distressed him when he had encountered it before. Any sort of mystification of his being was contrary to the imperial truth.
"Go on,"
he said.
There is a... The Raven Guard paused. A folklore, he said. A mythology in this camp.
Oh, Sanguinius said sharply.
Quite a specific one, and consistent across the worlds these people have fled.
Well, myths are turning out to have a very dangerous core of truth these days, said Raldoron.
So we have been coming to learn, Levanus said.
What are the stories being told? Ascalon asked.
Sanguinius held up a hand before Levanus answered.
I want to hear them first hand, he told the Raven Guard.
Take us below.
The Primarch's party walked away from the wall, down a relatively wide and straight avenue, one of a dozen radiating out from the fortress and dividing the camp into sectors. The Sanguinary Guard tried to form a cordon around Sanguinius, but he shook his head and walked on. The people lined the sides of the avenue, weeping at the sight of the angel. They held their arms out in entreaty. Sanguinius swallowed his distaste in the worship he saw in their eyes, and moved back and forth, touching the tips of fingers with his gauntlets. The hope he saw spread through the crowd had value, even if he did not like its source. It was what the refugees called to him that he wanted to hear, though.
"You will save us!" they cried. "The Emperor has heard us!
The Pilgrim will not find us here!
Shield us from the Pilgrim!"
The pleas were consistent, and Sanguinius saw the truth of what Levanus had said. The people before him were from a multitude of civilizations. No matter the skin tones and cultural encoding of their ragged clothes, they were unified in their desperate gratitude towards him and their terror of the Pilgrim. Sanguinius rejoined Levanus in the centre of the dusty avenue.
"The Pilgrim," he said, "what do they mean?"
"That hardly sounds like a name for Horus," Raldoron said. "Or perhaps one of Lorgar's zealots?"
Ascalon suggested.
"We have refugees from traitor-occupied worlds," Levanus said. "They don't talk about the Pilgrim." Sanguinius narrowed his eyes.
"So many of these people come from worlds that have not fallen to Horus's forces?"
"Most have not," said Levanus.
"The majority of the recent arrivals have been fleeing something else."
"Fleeing what?"
"I'm not sure. The stories are vague on that point. I'm not sure the people know themselves. Events have surpassed their ability to understand." He scanned the crowd, then pointed to a cluster of figures a few hundred yards ahead and to the right.
"I suggest you speak with them, Lord Sanguinius."
A score of men and women stood beneath the overhang of a broken girder. The metal fragment was the smallest part of a ship's framework, but it towered over this sector of the camp. It had been painted by what appeared to be hundreds of hands, endlessly reproducing the Aquila. The symbols overlapped and spread up the girder's height. The group beneath were all robed. They had shaven their heads and marked their scalps with the Aquila again, some with crude tattoos, others by having the symbol carved into their flesh. They knelt and bowed their heads as the angel and his party drew near. The people around them followed their example. Sanguinius frowned. He paused before approaching the group.
"This is a cult," he said to Levanus.
"It is."
"You seem unperturbed."
"The cult's loyalty to the Emperor is fanatical. The force of these people's belief has had some positive impact on the wider morale of the camp. Given the circumstances, Captain Calibus decided it was impractical and counterproductive to suppress it."
"You agree?"
"I do. Stamping it out would also have involved a waste of resources."
Levanus paused for a moment.
"But you see now, Lord Sanguinius, why your appearance is having a pronounced effect?"
"I do. It is not what I would choose."
"I understand. Nothing on Thrinos is what any of us would choose."
"No, I don't suppose it is."
The angel walked towards the kneeling mortals. He signalled Ascalon to keep the Sanguinary Guard a few steps back. He did not want these people so overwhelmed they could not speak.
"Stand,"
he said when he reached them.
"I would speak to you."
They stood. Like all the other refugees, they were ragged, malnourished, exhausted. Desperation and the terror of war had carved deep lines into their faces. There were weeping sores on their lips and on their arms.
But when they looked at Sanguinius, there was more than fear in their eyes. There was hope. It was primal, almost feral, and it refused to be extinguished.
"And tell me about the pilgrim," Sanguinius said. It took a moment before any of the mortals found their voices.
"It's the Destroyer Lord," said one man.
Sanguinius thought he was young, but the war had added decades to his age.
"It is the bringer of ruin," a woman said.
She was old. Her back was hunched. Her gnarled fingers had never known juvenile treatments.
"When it comes to a world, the world ends."
"It visited all of our worlds," said a second man.
He was missing his right arm.
"It travels, and where it passes, the end follows."
"It?" Sanguinius asked.
"The pilgrim is not a warrior, then?"
"No, Lord," said the woman.
"What is it, then?"
There was uncertainty again.
"It is blackness in the sky," the one-armed man said. "It is made of night."
Whatever the pilgrim was, it had been transformed in their minds by superstitious awe. And yet, Sanguinius exchanged a look with Ralderon. The first captain concealed his worry well, but Sanguinius could see it all the same. They shared the same thought. The descriptions of the pilgrim were disturbingly familiar.
"Is it a ship?" Sanguinius asked.
The mortals didn't seem to know. Instead of answering directly, they offered more myths. The pilgrim was to them less a thing than an event. It was darkness, and it brought darkness. Finally, the younger man said,
"It isn't a ship, Lord. It's too big."
"Have you served on vessels?" Sanguinius asked him.
"I have, on mass conveyors."
He spoke from experience, then. He was familiar with massive ships.
"The pilgrim is the end," the man continued. "It comes, and when we look up into the dark, we are looking at the doom of our world."
"What is the ruin it brings?"
Sanguinius thought he already knew the answer to that. There was yet another moment of silence, as if the mortals feared that their answers would be a conjuration. The old woman stepped forwards, seeking comfort in Sanguinius's shadow. She bowed her head and whispered,
"Nightmares. Nightmares that walk, and we cannot awake from the sight of them."
"And change," the younger man said. "The ruin is change. The worlds are transformed."
"Into what?" said the angel.
"Into nightmares."
"We thank the Emperor for you coming," said the one-armed man. "You will stop the dark fates, Lord. You will stop the pilgrim."
The hope in their eyes pulled at Sanguinius. It gave him no strength. They were feeding on his presence. He met with his brothers in the command chamber at the top of the keep's squat turret. It was a pyramidal structure on the roof. Narrow armour-glass windows looked out over the camp in every direction. The walls, floor and furnishings were iron. It was a space of cold functionality. Calibus brought the Primarchs to the room and then withdrew. When they were alone, the lion described what had been found outside the Pandorax system.
"The way to Terra is through Davin," he said.
Gilliman frowned. "Well, I understand that you believe this to be the case," he said. "Your message to us must have come at a great cost to your astropaths."
"It did," said the lion.
"And I understand that you felt the cost we paid to answer it was necessary as well?"
"I do."
"What I do not understand," said Gilliman, "is why you are convinced. Why, Davin? How will going there, assuming we can, bring us closer to Terra?" Sanguinius answered for the lion.
"Because Horus fell at Davin.
I know he was injured there, but..."
"No,"
Sanguinius cut him off. "That is where he fell, where he turned from our father." As soon as the lion had spoken the name of the world, Sanguinius had known his brother was right. The light coming in the windows turned brittle. The sense of onrushing fate reached into Sanguinius's heart with its freezing touch. He felt again as he had on the bridge of the Red Tear, with the shadow of the Phantom reaching for him. The limits of his perception thrummed with the beat of fate's advance.
"Granting that," Gilliman said, "what of it?"
He looked back and forth between the lion and the angel, as if eager to be convinced. That surprised Sanguinius. He expected Gilliman to hold fast to the reason. It was clear the lion had too. He was watching Gilliman closely, as if the avenging sun, and not the lion, was the one bearing strange news. Sanguinius heard doubt in Gilliman's voice, and he thought it was more doubt in himself than in Davin as a target.
"The Davinites did not travel to Pandarax by accident," said the lion. "Their journey was deliberate. The system was their destination. We found evidence of a ritual and of mass sacrifice. Now the system is inaccessible. The warp storm is one of the most violent I've ever seen."
"You infer a connection?" Gilliman said. The lion snorted.
"What is wrong with you, Rabute? I don't infer it, I declare it. We have seen too much now to embrace the dangerous fiction of a coincidence."
"That is so," said Gilliman. "But nor can we commit our fleets to anything less than a certainty."
"There was a Davinite on Cygnus Prime," Sanguinius said.
The other two Primarchs fell silent.
There was much he could not tell them about Cygnus Prime, for the sake of his sons and the future of his legion. The trauma of that war must fall to silence. But he would speak about some of the madness now, so both his brothers could see the path forwards as clearly as he did. Sanguinius didn't need the lion to convince him. If necessary, he would convince the lion.
"There was a Davinite," he said again, "and the demonic attack on the entire system was massive. I saw the stars vanish. I saw a planet made over into the symbol of chaos. The entire system was transformed. I can't know what Pandarax is undergoing inside that storm, but I can imagine it."
He took a breath.
"Horus fell at Davin," he said again. "This war begins at Davin. Maybe it ends there too."
Gilliman said nothing. He looked thoughtful, doubtful, still wanting to be convinced, still unable to let go of the dictates of reason.
"Did you make any headway towards Terra?" the lion asked.
Gilliman shook his head.
"And we were led here," said Sanguinius.
"That is troubling in and of itself," said Gilliman.
"It suggests we are walking into a trap. If the enemy wants us to take this path, we would be mad to do so."
"What enemy?" the lion asked. "I have not encountered any of the traitor forces."
"I have," said Gilliman.
"I have prisoners of the 17th Legion, navigators who were more than happy to offer to guide me here."
He turned to Sanguinius. "And who led you here?"
"I don't know."
Gilliman paced the length of the iron table. He tapped its surface as he walked, striking a rhythm on hard, unyielding reality.
"The case for Davin is a strong one," he said.
"Then we should accept the truth that Davin is the key to Terra, and that it is a trap," said the lion. "What better place to prepare an ambush than on the route a foe has no choice but to take?"
Gilliman stopped pacing. He tapped the table with his index finger, more slowly this time, more deliberately, as if counting off strategic postulates.
"If our fleets are destroyed, the galaxy falls," he said.
"But if we break our foes where they are strongest, then it is our victory that becomes the critical one," said the lion. "How better to storm that stronghold than with our combined fleets?"
"True," Gilliman said, still visibly uneasy.
"This is where our path takes us," Sanguinius told him.
"I believe you," said Gilliman, but the admission appeared to worry him.
"The question remains whether we can reach Davin. It may be as closed to us as Terra." "I don't think it will be."
"Davin is inevitable," Sanguinius thought. He could almost see the world rising above his temporal horizon. The Blood Angels had come to Thrinos through no choice of their own. Davin's pull would be even stronger. He was finding it difficult not to fall into a blank fatalism. His steps were predestined. Destiny was not negotiable. If he threw his fleet to the mercy of the warp, he would wash up on the threshold of Davin. He turned his mind away from the lunacy of that impulse. There was a difference between arriving at Davin in force and arriving as a shipwreck victim, You know your end, he reminded himself. You don't know its meaning.
That might still be under his control.
My navigators have a fix on the trajectory we must take, the lion said.
Impressive, said Gilliman.
I presume it would be futile to ask how they managed this feat.
We have our means, the lion said.
Gilliman sighed, but did not press the point.
It will take more than one jump, the lion went on. I would suggest our best strategy is as tight a formation as possible, with your navigators keyed to follow ours. We will be your beacon.
Agreed, Sanguinius said, and the shadow came a bit closer. He looked out of the window. The afternoon was fading into evening. Thick clouds covered the sky, the narrow breaks between them limned by the cold, golden light of the setting sun. The shadow he sensed came from something darker than approaching night. It overlaid everything he saw, yet was invisible to the eye.
Agreed, Gilliman said too, after a pause. Your ships have taken damage, the lion said. How long before you can depart?
We are voidworthy.
More extensive repairs are beyond what can be done here. The 13th Legion will be ready at dawn.
And so will the 9th, said Sanguinius.
At dawn, then, said the lion.
Levanus found Calibus on the peak of the fortress. It was a narrow spire, the platform surrounded by lethally sharp metal plates. Calibus stood motionless, an iron sentinel, looking out over the people who had come to him for refuge. He turned his head slightly at Levanus's approach and nodded very slightly.
The Sithelinus departs with the Legion fleets, Levanus said.
It does,
Calibus answered, his metallic voice making the curt response sound even harsher. Levanus joined him in gazing at the refugee camp.
We will be turning our backs on all who came to us for help, he said.
We go where the war takes us. We are warriors, not guardians. The battle calls us to terror. Remaining here would be pointless.
The people below would tell us otherwise. They would say we are abandoning them to their doom.
They may yet survive.
Not if the pilgrim comes here.
And if it does, and we are here, what good would we do?
None, Levanus admitted.
If half the tales the refugees told were true, a single strike cruiser would not last long against such an enemy.
Then we are agreed, said Calibus.
We are.
Calibus walked to the edge of the parapet. His fists closed over the adamantium crenellations. Levanus found the Iron Hands captain hard to read, even after years of combat together, but it seemed to him Calibus was struggling with a heavy weight.
When Atticus escaped the Istvan system, Calibus said, he had warriors from the 18th Legion with him, as well as from yours.
You're wondering what the Salamanders would say about leaving Thrinos to its fate.
I know exactly what they would say. It changes nothing.
He turned away from the camp.
I thought, when you arrived, that I would hear their argument from you.
Why?
Said the Raven Guard. Remaining, as you said, would be a poor strategy.
I'm not sure. Perhaps I imagined, because you are still more flesh than I am, that you would feel closer to the flesh below us.
Levanus found the camp hard to look at now, too.
You may be right, he said. I knew what must be done when I climbed the steps of this tower. But if I'm honest, I wanted to hear you make the case for leaving.
Calibus grunted. It was the sound of gears slipping, the closest he came to laughter.
Any hint of doubt from me is unwelcome, then. It seems we are disappointing each other.
The truth of the matter is, whether we like it or not, we have been the guardians of Thrinos these past years.
And now that ends, said Calibus. The flesh is weak, and that is also the truth. These people must find their strength or die.
He paused.
But if, with the force of three legions, we encounter the pilgrim, that would be a battle worth fighting.
Salvation for Thrinos after all?
Levanus asked. The hope felt like a grim one. With a visible effort, Calibus faced the camp one last time.
It is the only salvation we can offer.
There is one other matter we need to address, said Levanus.
Of course, said Celebus. You and your battle brothers will be rejoining your legion.
I have spoken with the Lion. If you agree, we shall serve out his mission aboard the Sethelenus. Celebus was silent for a moment, save for the faint hum of servo motors. Then he said,
You honour me, brother.
The honour is mine, brother.
Then we shall finish the long journey from Istvan together.
The shadow came for Thrinos with nightfall, spreading with the name Davin. It covered the land, seeping into the camps and into the tortured sleep of the refugees. It clasped the fleets at low anchor. It travelled the halls of battleships and strike cruisers. The mortal crew members who were off shift slept as badly as the civilians on Thrinos. The dreams were not uniform. The shadow took whatever shapes twisted through the unconscious of its victims and turned them to its ends. Dreams of loss or hope or anger, of grief or home or victory, of desperation or of faith, all were tainted by Davin. Davin, Davin. Premonitions descended on psychers, opening vistas of terror to them that were unformed, but threatened to acquire monstrous definition. The Dark Angels lost more astropaths, and the Ultramarines more navigators, as the more psychically damaged of their numbers fell to the new onslaught. But there was nothing to fight against. No enemy declared itself. There was only the sense of coming immensity. And that was enough. More than enough. The horrors, in time yet to come, in distances yet to be travelled, were that strong. The Ultramarines and the Dark Angels experienced the shadow as a tensing towards the future, of an unseen enemy probing resolution before the encounter. Gilliman kept his vault sealed, but his thoughts went to the Athames, and he raged silently against the sense that every decision was foretold, every choice an illusion, even as the choice about whether to use the enemy's tools hovered before him. The Lion sequestered himself in the chamber of Tuchulcha. He spoke to the meat puppet. He tried, and he failed, to summon answers that would satisfy him.
"Where are the barriers between here and Davin?" he asked.
"Before us,"
said the servitor.
"I warn you not to trifle with me."
"I do not,"
said Tuchulcha.
"That truths displease you is no fault of mine."
"Then give me the truths I seek. How far can you take us in a single leap?"
"To the limits of my sight."
"That is not an answer."
"It is still the truth."
The Lion's eyes narrowed.
"Will you be clear, or will I have you destroyed?"
"I am as clear as blindness permits."
"My blindness?"
"No,"
said the puppet.
"Mine."
The admission of limitations was new from Tuchulcha. It was disturbing.
"If you are blind, how do you know our way is blocked?"
"Because something will stop my sight."
"Where?"
"My blindness is not measured by location. I know it will occur."
The Lion went around and around with Tuchulcha, growing more and more uneasy as he became convinced the being was not trying to deceive him. He emerged from the chamber hours later, no wiser than when he had entered. He was left with only the certainty of uncertainty, and the knowledge that he was dragging his brothers down a broken path. The shadow touched the Blood Angels too. It fell on the angel first, and spread out from him onto his sons. In the privacy of the Sanctorum Angelus, Sanguinius meditated, seeking the way to find meaning in destiny. Instead, he felt Horus strike the fatal blow. He gasped. He fell to his hands and knees. The marble beneath him did not go dark with his blood, yet every wound was real. His brother's blade soared through his hearts, his sight greyed with the pain. A massive figure in black flickered before him, and the walls of the Red Tear shivered, on the verge of becoming the foulness of the vengeful spirit. Dark, black, night. Everything was darkness, and so was the thing that rose inside him. It was not blood. It was nothing physical. It was not the thirst. It was something else. So black he could not know it, yet it was his. Yet it was him. He shouted a denial. His voice rang against marble and gold. He curled in on himself, clutching hard, holding back darkness. It strained to be released. His will was stronger. And as the spectral pain faded, so did the dark. His vision stabilized. The sanctorum became stable again. He stood up, unsure whether he had claimed a victory or suffered another blow. Across his fleet, the Blood Angels paused in their preparations for war and blinked at the wave of anguish that rolled over them. With the coming of dawn, the shadow did not dissipate. It lingered in the hollows of secret thoughts and fears. It was a venomous dust in the corners of every soul on the surface of Thrinos and in orbit over it. Mortal and Legiones Astartes and Primarch, all felt it, and all moved on to confront it. The warriors of three legions were ready to make war, and they would burn the shadow from their consciousness with the light of their righteous anger. The mortals below did not have the same strength. They saw the saviors they had prayed for leave Thrinos. Even the Iron Hands departed, leaving the fortress empty. So there was no celebration as three fleets raised anchor. The people looked up at the vessels, at the daylight stars that stood between them and the violent sight of the ruin storm. Then the stars began to move away. The lights of hope departed Thrinos, and the wail of a great mourning followed them.